This is Talk of the Nation. I'm Neil Conan in Washington. Most Americans see the British as our closest cultural counterparts, and not just because of language. Despite a rocky start, it's developed into a pretty solid, some might even say, special relationship. They gave us the Magna Carta. We gave them Elvis. We make fun of their royals. They make fun of, well, us. Writer Joe Queenan is closer to the mother country than most. He married a British woman, but a couple of years ago he decided to go there without his wife, skip the visit to Uncle Gordon and Auntie Margaret, and see Britain for himself. He hit Liverpool and London, the Scottish Highlands and the Welsh countryside, and just about every place in between, where he discovered a lot he loved, a lot he didn't, and even more he didn't understand. Almost none of it, though, reminded him of home. Later in the program, comedian George Carlin joins us to talk about his new book, but first Joe Queenan's new book, Queen and Country. If you've been to Britain, call and tell us what you have to see, what you have to skip, and what you just have to stand there and scratch your head about. Our phone number is 800-989-8255. That's 800-989-TALK. And the email address is totn@npr.org. Author Joe Queenan joins us here in Studio 3A. Good to have you back on the program.
Nice to be here.
And besides being proclaiming yourself a reluctant Anglophile, you are an unreluctant sports fan. I have to begin by asking you, I'm sure you've seen the video of what happened in Detroit on Friday night a thousand times. Worst thing I've ever seen. Let's watch it again. What did you make of that?
Well, Ron Artest is a head case, as we know. So something like this was probably going to happen. I mean, he really does have problems. His behavior has been very strange. The whole thing about asking for some time off so that he could promote his compact disc. He's been suspended a lot of times, so this was bound to happen. On the other hand, I have always felt that it was completely idiotic and inappropriate for the fans to sit as close as they do to the players at basketball games. I have always felt that Spike Lee has no business being on the court, that Jack Nicholson has no, but they do not play professional basketball. They should not be sitting that close. And if you've sat courtside, the abuse, particularly from the smaller fans, is always quite amazing. It's always the guys who hide behind the idea that, the security people will protect us or the athletes will be on their best behavior. I think there was a guy in Washington who was famous for this, for going out and taunting people.
He's staying in a seat and taunting people, Robin Ficker.
Right. A guy who, if you put him in an alley with one of these guys, he'd probably keep a civil tongue in his head.
He's a lawyer. You never know.
Yeah, you never know. But I remember a couple of years ago when there was a guy who was spilling beer on Ty Domi from the Toronto Maple Leafs up in Philadelphia during a Flyers game, and the supports gave out, and he crashed into the penalty box, and Ty Domi wailed on him in there. And I think that guy, and I think a lot of fans, learned something. These are professional sportsmen, and I don't think that the fans should be allowed to sit as close as they do, and I think that the league will have to look into this.
For those who are not sports fans, Ty Domi plays the position in hockey known as enforcer.
He's an enforcer, yeah, he's a goon. Yeah. He's actually a talented goon. He can actually score, but he really looks the part of the goon. But Artest, the guy's a very talented guy, but like Dennis Rodman, he has really serious problems, because most players in any sport are so used to this kind of abuse that they would just ignore it. And he just went totally nuclear. So
now we'll get back to Britain by making this clever transition to say, while you were there, I know among the things you like to do is go to the occasional soccer game. Of course, British soccer, the home of hooliganism.
Yes.
And what's the difference?
Well, hooliganism was toned down considerably in the Margaret Thatcher era. They put seats in, which really changed things a lot. Before then, people used to always stand in these throngs. They put seats in, they have video cameras, so they make sure that the worst hooligans don't get in, and they raise the prices. So if you go to an Arsenal game, it's amazing, because the fans still verbally behave very badly. They say very abusive things, but they're all website designers now. I mean, everybody at these games is very, very, very middle class. And it's sort of like hockey here, in that if you go to a professional hockey game, the crowds do behave, they sort of revert to this kind of Jurassic Man. But they're all lawyers. They're all accountants. Everybody's got some kind of pretty good paying job, because otherwise you couldn't afford to go to these games. Mm-hmm. It's the same way at Yankees games. I mean, it's just, you know, you see that crowd there that's so macho and intense and rude. And to go to Yankees games, to go to any of these games, you have to have a fairly decent salary. So there's a certain element that it's kind of put on. However, if you go to some of the cities like Manchester United's fans, that's a pretty rough crowd of people. Millwall in London, which is not the top division, that's a pretty nasty group of people, and you wouldn't want to go to their games by yourself.
You end up in a lot of neighborhoods you really wouldn't want to go to by yourself.
Well, I grew up in a lot of bad neighborhoods in Philadelphia, and visiting bad neighborhoods is my hobby. It's something that I've always enjoyed doing it. Usually by day, but I remember when I was in Glasgow, I went up to where the Celtic team plays, and you shouldn't go up there if you're not wearing green, because that's the Catholic part of town, and the Rangers is the Protestant part of town, and it's the kind of area that you probably wouldn't want to be there at night, and you wouldn't want to be there unless you were with some Scottish people, and you wouldn't want to be there unless you were with some Scottish Catholics.
Mm-hmm. Same in Liverpool, if you were going to see either Liverpool or Everton. One of them is the Catholic team and one the Protestant team.
Yeah, well, I was in Newcastle on Good Friday, and I was going to stay in Newcastle because a lot of young people had told me that Newcastle's a really great town, in the way that people will say that Baltimore's a really great town. Because young people always look at towns in terms of the parties that are going on and the chemicals that are being consumed. Whereas as you get older, you just go to towns and you look at the physical structure of the town. And if it doesn't appear to be particularly charming, I don't care how good the parties are. I don't stay there. Newcastle looked like a real dump. It's where Eric Burdon and the Animals are from. It looked like a dump that was making its way back, but a dump nevertheless. I was going to stay there overnight. And then suddenly I saw literally thousands of Everton fans coming down the street. And they had won. They had beaten Newcastle, but they were behaving in this sort of spectacularly bad way that British football fans will behave. And I decided to get out, and I went to Durham, which is 20 minutes away and the site of Britain's oldest and most magnificent cathedral.
And most spacious, but I was going to point out you ran into the animals themselves a little bit later in your sojourn in Scotland, of all places.
I literally ran into three surviving members of the Animals. There was a concert at the Royal Opera Hall in Glasgow one night, and three of the original Animals were there. One of them has since died, and he was the one who, after the concert, asked me how to get to Doncaster. And I thought it was very strange to be asked for directions by somebody who actually was from Great Britain. You know, Great Britain's not terribly hard. It's not terribly hard to figure out where you're going. It's not like Washington, D.C. So I said, well, if you're in Scotland and you're looking for a place in England, I would just say head south. You probably can't miss it.
When you went all those times to England with your wife and meeting with your wife's family, I'm sure you went and did a lot of the touristy things, some of the most important places.
Yes, but we did them over and over and over again. We always went to London and we saw Westminster Abbey and Magna Carta. There's two copies of it in the British Museum. And then we would go and see friends in the East End of London. And then we would go see Annie Margaret and Cousin Robin. And then we would come back a year later and we would come to London and we'd go to see Westminster Abbey and Trafalgar Square, and we'd have a curry in Soho, and then we'd go to see Annie Margaret and Cousin Robin. And we always went to see. Everything was organized around my wife's relatives. So one time, or friends. So one time we went all the way to Aberdeen in Scotland, which is a rather amazingly uninteresting city, except for the fact that it's entirely made of granite. So it's just a very odd city, and they have crescents. They have these crescent-shaped streets. Now, the crescents in Bath or the crescents in parts of London are these beautiful Georgian buildings that are very elegant. In Aberdeen, they have crescents, these half-moons, but they're made of granite. It's a very, very strange thing to say. Well, in any case, we went all the way to Aberdeen because my wife had friends there, but we didn't go to Edinburgh, and we didn't go to Glasgow. And, of course, everybody who goes to Scotland goes to Edinburgh.
Our number, if you'd like to join the conversation, is 800-989-8255, 800-989-TALK. Our email address is totn@npr.org. I'm going to be asking a lot of our callers the same question, Joe Queenan. What, after all of this, did you decide, if you were going back, you must see, and what have you decided you must not?
I think that the one place, the place that I most love is Berkeley, which is in the Cotswolds. And the reason is that Berkeley is a small village. I'm a very economical tourist, so I don't like to have to cover a huge amount of distance to do things. Berkeley Castle is where Edward II was brutally murdered by his wife, Isabella, the She-Wolf of France. All this is depicted in Mel Gibson's fine motion picture, Braveheart. He was impaled on a red-hot poker. It was apparently a prank that got well out of hand. It was a great surprise to him. And you can go to Berkeley Castle and you can see where he was murdered. But the people who work there don't like to talk about the specific details. Now, that's great. But right across the street is the Edward Jenner Museum, which is the smallpox museum. Mm-hmm. And that's where Edward Jenner discovered the cure for smallpox. He discovered it by just basically practicing on a lot of manservants and people like that and small children. That's great. So you've got these two things right across the street from each other. But across from that, you have a Saxon church, which is 1,000 years old. And in the church are the remains of Dicky Pierce, the last court jester in the history of England. Dicky Pierce, according to local legend, died in revelry. And it took me a long time to find out what that actually means. And what it means is, he was being the lads got kind of drunk one night,
no,
and they started tossing Dicky Pierce, the jester, in a blanket, and somebody lost control of his end of the blanket, and Dicky went flying off the musician's gallery, the minstrel's gallery, landed on his head and died. This happened in the early 1700s. They could never get anyone to replace him, so that was literally the end of it. And on his tomb is an epitaph by Jonathan Swift, and it's something like, Dicky, Dicky, Dicky Pierce, boy, we miss him, something fierce. And we just don't have anything. We don't have anything like that here.
No.
We don't have, and if we did, I mean, here we have like Washington, the Washington Monument, but then you have to go thousands of miles to see Custer's Last Stand, and then you have to go all the way back east to Gettysburg, and then you have to go all the way down to the Book Depository in Dallas, whereas in England, it's all very, very comfortably arranged because it's such a microscopic size, it's a postage size country. I can't recommend it too highly.
800-989-8255, 800-989-TALK. Email is TOTN at NPR.org. Danny is with us from Cleveland, Ohio.
Hi.
How you doing?
I'm doing okay. I lived in England for over 20 years. I'm actually an American, currently live in Cleveland, Ohio. And I was going to suggest one of the best things you can possibly do in England is to spend as much time in pubs as possible, because I don't know what your guest thinks of this, but they're not bars, they're not restaurants. America has nothing like it. And when people ask me, why don't they just build one, I say, you can't. It's part of the culture. And on the negative side, I was going to say, do not go to Hull. It smells of fish and cooking oil. And that's basically the whole city. It's 30% odd unemployment. It's the most dire place on the planet I've ever been to.
Any reason to disagree with either of Danny's points? Thanks for the phone call, Danny.
Well, you certainly don't want to go to any pubs in Hull, I'll tell you that. I agree with the thing about pubs, except only certain pubs. Don't go into pubs in the East End of London by yourself, certainly not on a Friday night. Don't go into pubs wearing the wrong collar in Liverpool. Don't go into pubs wearing the wrong. It's true that particularly in the countryside in England, what's great about pubs is in the United States, there's the biker bar, there's the gay bar, there's the working man's bar, there's the yuppie bar, and they're pretty much segregated. People pretty much stick to themselves. In England, when you go into a pub, everybody's there, especially if it's in a small village. So you'll see hippies, you'll see bikers, you'll see Aryan Nation type people, you'll see old people, you'll see people who want to talk about Gallipoli, you'll see them all together, and that's great. But the level of drinking that goes on in some of the pubs is a little bit worrying.
We're talking with Joe Queenan about his new book, Queenan Country, which explores some of the curiosities of the British Isles. 800-989-8255. I'm Neil Conan. Back after a break, this is NPR News. This is Talk of the Nation. I'm Neil Conan in Washington. We're talking today with Joe Queenan. His latest book is Queen and Country, A Reluctant Anglophile's Pilgrimage to the Mother Country. It's part travelogue, part rumination on some of the eccentricities of British and American life. Of course, you're invited to join the conversation. Our number is 800-989-8255, 800-989-TALK. Our email address is totn@npr.org. And Joe Queenan, I know you insist at the beginning that this is not a travel book.
No, I hate travel books. The problem with travel books is that you know where the next chapter is going to take you, so that if they're in Portsmouth in Chapter 1, they're going to be in Plymouth in Chapter 2, and then they're going to be in Brighton in Chapter 3. And there's something, the thing that I don't like about travel books is that there's an awful lot of discussion of the weather and a lot of discussion of how hard it was for me to get a hotel room and things like that. So I, with the exception of Paul Theroux's amazing book, The Kingdom by the Sea, which is a great book, and obviously Johnson and Boswell, and Bruce Chatwin wrote some great travel books, but most of the others I just don't like. No, it's basically about how when you marry someone from a foreign country, their country becomes your hobby for the rest of your life. And you become fascinated by finding out how many of the things that you are puzzled by or don't like about them are native to their personality and how many of them are native to their nationality.
And did you, everybody, you know, excoriates the idea that there is such a thing as national character.
There absolutely is national character. There's absolutely a sense of we must put aside for a rainy day because rationing could return. There's absolutely a sense of we cannot just jump in the car and drive to Fresno. We have to plan. We have to, what are we going to eat? Where are we going to stay? There's really that kind of a sense. Until quite recently, until Margaret Thatcher, I think there was also a strong sense that there was something evil about commerce. Whereas in the United States, we don't have that. I mean, every single thing in the United States is commercialized, including 9/11. Things just immediately, there's about 12 hours when people step back from things, and then immediately everything turns into some commercial event, as the Ron Artest thing will. We'll see T-shirts all over the place about that. We'll see skits about it. I think that that's one of the basic differences. I think that in England also, there's very much a sense that early in life that you've been dealt some cards and you're going to have to play those cards. And Americans don't believe that. It's a totally aspirational society. So Americans, I mean, I think somebody told me Town and Country has 570,000 readers. Now there are only 338,000 millionaires in the country or something like that, or people with more than 10 million. And yet here are all these people reading a magazine about renting a palazzo in Tuscany. And it's because Americans conceive of life in terms of what they're going to have. And I think part of the reason that a lot of poor Americans vote Republican is because they figure, I don't have any money, but if I ever did, the Republicans would let me keep it. And I think that that's one of the big differences is that there's a kind of largeness of spirit about Americans and a kind of sense of just anything is possible. Whereas in Britain, we just had this thing with Prince Charles, with this court case where there was this letter that he wrote basically telling people, you've got to learn to stay in your place. Not everybody can be king. Not everybody can be head of the corporation. Somebody's got to be the secretary. Well, you're never supposed to say things like that. And you certainly are never supposed to say them in a place like the United States, where everybody thinks, no, I could grow up to be president of the United States.
Here's an email we got to somebody in the opposite situation of yourself. As a British guy married to an American living in Kent, Ohio, I can say the main divide between Britain and America is religion. In Britain, we spend more time in the pub than in church and are much happier as a result. That and that we believe taxes should be spent on health care and not warfare. The tragedy is not enough British people get to see how wonderful the average Americans are.
Okay. Well, first of all, they do spend money on health care, but they spend it on bad health care. So I have some problems with that. However, the thing about religion is very interesting because British history until about 200 years ago was a history of almost uninterrupted religious warfare. So the reason that they're not religious people, the British are not religious. There are churches, but there's nobody in them. When you go to places like Birmingham, all the churches have been converted into mosques or into pizza expresses because religion is not—it's not important in the way it is here. But we didn't have religious wars here. I mean, we may be having them now, but we've never had the kinds of wars that they had, where literally under Oliver Cromwell, they ripped the country apart. And after Oliver Cromwell, Somebody once said that the United States was founded by 50 men and a ghost, and the ghost was Oliver Cromwell, because the founding fathers said, we are not going to have religious warfare in this country, but we have a lot of religion.
Let's get another caller on the line. Bob is with us from Blairstown, New Jersey.
Hi, how are you?
Okay.
This is a great show today. My daughter married a Brit. And we go over there, and when we go, we're very close to her in-laws, and they took us on a tour of southeastern England. We went to Stonehenge, and I think the most amazing thing about it was we got there. As we're going over the hill to come up to Stonehenge, my daughter's mother-in-law turned and said, think small, because we think of Stonehenge as absolutely enormous, and it isn't, because you never see it with people around it.
That's a good point. It's like the Mona Lisa. People are always amazed at the size of the Mona Lisa. There's a couple of Bierstadt paintings in Washington. The last buffalo hunt, I think, is another one that always amazes people, as they think it's this like gigantic painting, and it isn't. Stonehenge, one thing about Stonehenge is that the first time I went there in the late 70s, you could actually walk up to it. You could park your car.
You're about 50 feet away from it.
Well, there's a fence around it. And you know why there's a fence around it? Jethro Tull fans, absolutely. It's because of hippies having their weird druidic rites. I think Stevie Nicks may have been involved in this in some way, but witchcraft, warlocks.
Spinal Tap,
the Knights Templar, the Spear of Longinus, the Da Vinci Code, all of that kind of like...
All of that kind of like
bargain basement wackiness ended the moment. I would really like it if Stonehenge could go back to being free, because I remember the first time I saw it, we came and it was not yet dark, and I just looked and thought, well, just some stupid rocks. And then once it gets dark, it becomes quite eerie and chilling, and something that you don't forget.
It's about 1:30 in the afternoon when it gets dark there, isn't it?
Yeah. Well, in Scotland, it gets dark about 10 in the morning. But you're absolutely right. It's shocking when you get there and you realize that it isn't that big.
I have to say that on my one trip to Stonehenge, the thing I most remember that sticks out vividly in my memory is a tank exercise. It's Salisbury Plain, and this is a famous home of British tank schools since the First World War. And there were these Challenger tanks ripping down these roads at 45 miles an hour. It was amazing.
And there's another Stonehenge. There's kind of a triple-A Stonehenge about 20 miles away called Avebury. And that's standing stones that aren't as impressive as at Stonehenge, but they're right across from a pub. And you can go into the pub and get your drink, and then you can go and sit on these stones that are literally thousands of years old. And in true British fashion, they're not content to say that the Druids brought them from Wales. Now there are theories that they may have been brought by the ancient Egyptians. And that's one of the things that I love about the Brits, is that enough is never enough with their mythology. They're always trying to think of a way to get Joseph of Arimathea or Ramses the Great into it. And it's like, you already have Oliver Cromwell and Winston Churchill and King Arthur. Can't you just tone it down a little? But they always want to have more.
And it would have to be a churlish geologist who would point out that all the rocks you sit on are much more than thousands of years old. But anyway.
Yes. And you know, something that always amazes me is how anything survives. Like, they practically destroyed Tintern Abbey during the time of Henry VIII, but they didn't completely destroy it. So it was like they took the rocks away. They took all the gold away. They took all the stained glass windows away. And then they took most of the rocks away, but they didn't take all of the rocks away. And you just figure, well, that happened 500 years ago. Did someone step in and say, let's leave a few rocks just in case, you know, we might need some tourism in here, 500.
Planning ahead.
And the same thing with Hadrian's Wall. Do you know why Hadrian's Wall is still standing?
No.
Because it was used as the fourth side of a cattle enclosure. I mean, Hadrian's Wall is a wall, and it never kept the Scots out. It never kept the Picts out. It never kept the Danes out. It couldn't keep anybody out except the cows. It kept the cows out of England, and that's why it's still there.
Well, it worked.
Little known facts.
We're talking with Joe Queenan. His new book is Queen and Country. Bob, if you're still there, thank you for the phone call.
Thank you.
A little far afield from your question. Let's go to Scott. Scott is calling from Minneapolis.
Hey, how you doing?
All right.
Well, in my opinion, you should rent a car and head straight north into the Highlands, because it was the most incredible trip I've ever taken, other than almost wetting my pants the first time I went into a four-lane turnabout, roundabout.
The wrong direction, yes.
Yeah, and on the wrong side of the car. I mean, it's like the moon with grass. That's the only way I could describe it. And I learned three things.
That's Scotland, not the roundabout, but go ahead.
Oh, that's the highlands. And there's three things I learned up there. Don't go alone, because it's just too incredible. If you go alone, you're going to be looking over at the empty passenger seat, and you're going to keep going, oh, my God, look at that. Oh, my God, look at that. So don't go alone. Don't be afraid of haggis, because it's really not that bad. And the last is, you know, I learned this on the last night I was there. You know, I kept leaving tips for waitresses in pubs.
They don't like that.
Yeah, and they don't like that. And sometimes, like, a guy from down the row will take the money and bring it back and give it to you. And I finally learned that what you do is, you know, say you buy a beer, you buy one for her. You say, have one for yourself, too. And she's like, oh, thanks. And what happens is, I guess they have a kind of higher hourly rate, so they don't get tipped. But after their shift, they have a little list of the beers that were bought for them, and then they have a beer. So it's... Unfortunately, I learned this on the last night of the trip, but just tell the waitress to have one for herself, and they charge you for two, and everyone's happy.
I had a friend from Scotland whose name was Hamish McCura, which sounds like a really thoroughly Scottish name, although McCura is actually Hungarian. His parents came over from Hungary after the war, and he explained the whole thing about tipping to me, and he said that when you put a pound on the bar anywhere in the UK, you are literally telling the person, that's what I think of you, you are worth £1, and they don't like it, and it's something that you have to be careful about. As for driving in Scotland, the one really big problem with driving in Scotland is there's only one place to overtake in the entire country. We were behind a VW bus going from Aberdeen to Loch Ness, which is about 100 miles, I guess, and there was just one place to overtake in the entire country. There's just, I mean... they don't have two-lane highways. They have like a half-a-lane highway, and it gets quite dark early in the day, and people get pretty tanked up in the winter. So it's not a great place to drive. And most of the time when I was around there, I traveled by train. The other thing that I noticed about Scotland, though, was very much like in Virginia, you can't go anywhere in Virginia that Robert E. Lee didn't sleep. I mean, every hotel, Robert E. Lee slept there, he drank there, he ate there, he wrote a letter to his sister there. And in Scotland, everywhere you go, Robert the Bruce did something. This is where Robert the Bruce hid from Edward Longshanks. This is where Robert the Bruce met William the Wallace. This is where... And I had just had enough of Robert the Bruce by the time I got out of that country. There was something about the immediacy of this medieval mythology that kind of wore me down.
Joe Queenan is our guest. His newest book is Queen and Country, A Reluctant Anglophile's Pilgrimage to the Mother Country. Scott, thanks very much for the phone call.
Thank you.
You're listening to Talk of the Nation from NPR News. One of the establishments in Scotland that you took some offense to is the Ness Café.
Well, that wasn't in Scotland. That was in York.
There is one in Scotland.
Yes, there is one. The Ness Café, actually, the Ness Café is in Scotland, and the place that I was at was Lucy Luckett's Tea Shop, which was a converted, it's a like a gatehouse on a bridge across the river in York. And I don't like all the sort of chuchiness that you find. I don't like stores with names like Sally Slap Cabbage and Mrs. Bumble's Tea Shop and Piggly Wiggly and Wombly Dombly. And there's all that kind of cuddliness that I find quite unnerving because we don't really have much of it. What we have is just complete Hallmark greeting card insipidity. But I prefer
that. You find
that.
A couple of those villages up in the Berkshires now, come on.
Yeah, in the Berkshires you find stores with names like the Improvident Patroon and things like that. But you know that, or the Antic Cobbler. But you know that it's like somebody named Steinmetz who bought it in 1978 and who set it up. But in England, you just find all that. The Parson's Buttocks Pub, you know, or the Monkey and Noose, or you know, the Shrill Wren, and there's just something, they overdo that so much, that whole that Beatrix Potter thing that really gets to you after a while, and you see it all over the place. That's one of the things about Hull that's great. You don't have any of those Sally Slapcabbage shops. If you go to the really grim northern industrial cities like Sheffield, you don't have any of that stuff up there. It's just pretty rough and coarse.
Did you find, though, that after about 15 minutes of listening to somebody's conversation up there, you just lose it? They might as well be speaking, you know, Martian?
Well, they talk a lot about football up there, and they, it's hard. The hardest place I've ever been to talk to people, French Canada is a hard place to talk to people, because the French people can't understand the French Canadians. So if you speak French as a second language, you can't understand them. The Yorkshire accent. I was on a bus with a gravedigger. You know, it's one of my hobbies. And I was going out to visit the moors, and the gravedigger was telling me, "I'm going to fix some fixes." And I was, "What?" He's going, "I've got some leaks and fixes." And the fixes were foxes. He had foxes. God knows where he got the foxes from. But he was going to make a leek and fox cassoulet or something like that, which sounded pretty horrible. But the accent is really amazing. And the other thing is,
I spent a coal strike up in Yorkshire, and my question, you can go back to the tapes, the question I constantly ask every single person I ran into is, "Come again?"
Yes. Yeah.
I'm sorry, what did you say?
Well, this guy was from Whitby, and Whitby is where there's the ruined castle that was the model for the Count Dracula's castle in Bram Stoker's Dracula. And this guy was a gravedigger, and he asked me where I was from, and I said I was from Philadelphia, and he said, "Oh, is that in California?" And I just thought, how is it possible? How is it possible for, I mean, we don't know that much about each other's countries, but Philadelphia isn't a small city.
He must have seen Rocky sometime.
He must have seen Rocky. He must have heard of it. And we just got talking, and it was great because it was one of these conversations where I couldn't entirely make out what he was saying, and he didn't understand my sense of humor. So he told me that he stopped being a grave digger because he had a heart attack while he was digging a grave. That's and convenient. I said, "Well, that was convenient." And he says, "No, it wasn't. I had a heart attack, and it was hot. Oh, it was hot. I couldn't go back and have my fixes." And I was saying, "But no, you were in a grave. So if you keeled over with a heart attack," and he says, "But it wasn't my grave that I was digging." And he's just like, "Oh, yeah. Let's go back to the fixes. Let's go back to talking about the fixes."
We're going to take a short break now, and we want to inform our listeners George Carlin will not be able to be with us today. He's feeling a little bit under the weather. He hopes to join us later this week. We'll try to reschedule that. The good news is that Joe Queenan will stay with us for a few more questions when we come back from a short break, and we'll get an update on what Congress did and did not get done this session, and of course the lame duck session that was tacked on after the election. If you'd like to join us again, the phone number is 800-989-8255, 800-989-TALK. The email address is totn@npr.org. I'm Neil Conan. It's Talk of the Nation from NPR News. And again, if you were tuning in to hear George Carlin, he's feeling a little bit under the weather. We're hoping to reschedule him for some time later this week. Still with us is Joe Queenan, the author of Queen and Country, A Reluctant Anglophile's Pilgrimage to the Mother Country. Let's get another caller on the line. And this is Jennifer. Jennifer's calling from Battle Creek, Michigan.
Hi there. How are you doing?
Very well, thank you.
Good. My husband and I took our honeymoon in England, and we rented a car and drove all over the place, but our most memorable experience was Edinburgh. We went through the castle, and then we stayed at a bed and breakfast in town called the Curtle House with a fabulous empty nesters. And it happened to be, I don't know, there must have been some hot air balloon fest while we were there. And we saw a giant Scotsman hot air balloon, and that was the most memorable bit of our experience.
A giant Scotsman hot air balloon? How much of the Scotsman did we see?
We did look under his skirt, and all that was there was the basket.
Sorry, I wasn't in town for that. I was in Edinburgh for the first time, and the thing that I most remembered was it was during the Six Nations rugby tournament. The Scots have a terrible rugby team. And the French have a great rugby team, but the French and the Scots get along very well because they hate the English. So the French laid off the Scots that day and beat them, I think, like 27-10. But when you go to the stadium, there's 50,000 Scots, and they're all dressed like Braveheart. They all have their faces painted blue. And then the French come, and they're all dressed like the Three Musketeers, and everybody's drunk, but everybody gets along really, really well. I mean, everybody just has a really, really good time. And then about a week after that, I went to a soccer match in London between Arsenal and Tottenham Hotspurs. And they don't like each other. They don't have any kind of camaraderie or anything like that. But one of the things that I remember about that day was there was a Japanese bagpipe player on Princes Street in Edinburgh, which was something that I had never seen before. And I went up to him, and he said, "Bagpipes are very popular in Japan." And I thought, one more reason that I'm not going to Japan anytime soon.
Another of your cultural experiences in Scotland was the concert of the Eagles tribute band.
That was in England, actually.
I apologize. That
was in a town called Stroud, which is where my wife grew up. Stroud is a rather uninteresting town that's ringed by places that are very interesting. And one day I saw an advertisement for a band called Talon. And they were an Eagles tribute band. So I went to see them, and I talked to them at some length, and it turns out that there are about 5 full-time Eagles tribute bands that go back and forth across the provincial towns in England, in Wales, in Scotland, in Norway, in Sweden, in Germany. And just the idea of an English tribute band going to Sweden or Norway to play Peaceful Easy Feeling. And it was a very strange experience there because they would come out and they would start singing. They were very good musicians, and they would start singing, "You can leave anytime you have, but you can never leave. Welcome to the hotel." And then the leader of the band started saying, "Could you put your hands together and give it up for Colin Montgomery from North Wiltshire?" And it was just, "But you're not Don Henley. You're not Joe Walsh. The illusion has been spoiled." Well, just translate that to Norway. I mean, it's it's 6 degrees of weirdness separation. And as a matter of fact, I think I'm going to go to Norway to see one of these bands.
I did see a British country and western band at a bar in Bahrain in the Persian Gulf. That was a little strange.
Well, you know, one of the things that's very interesting about the British is they are very, very devoted musical preservationists. So I went down to Oxford one day and wandered into the annual meeting of the British Viola da Gamba Society. And the viola da gamba is the prototype of the cello. And the great thing about being a viola da gamba player is nobody can tell if you're really terrible at it, because you can just say, "Well, it's an old instrument and it's out of tune." But they really go in for preserving strange things, like this whole idea of paying tribute to the Eagles in rural English towns. And then of the thing of there was a band I saw in London called the Rapiers, who believed that pop music died with the Beatles, that the music that was great was the music just before the Beatles.
Oh, I see. The Beatles killed it.
The Beatles killed the radio stars, the guys who played Telstar and Tequila, you know, and da-dan-dan-dan-dan-dan-dan, music like that. That was the golden age. So you have these middle-aged men dressed in gray suits with calf-high leather boots and pencil-string little ties, and they have a newsletter where they use that, you know, that early 60s Tiger Beat lingo?
Sure.
Like, the lads are going into the studio to record a new LP. And they're crazy.
I think those are LUDs.
Yeah, but they're just crazy. They're just insane people. But I think the thing that I like about it is when I talk to them, I never get a sense that it was a put-on the way it is here. The way, like, if you go to a bar and you see an ABBA tribute band, mm-hmm. it's nudge, nudge, wink, wink. It's always a joke. It's cheap irony. Over there, they are, in fact, delusional. They're just, like, out to an extremely long lunch. And I think that that's part of their appeal.
Jennifer, again, we've wandered a little off your point, but thank you for the phone call. Let's see if we get one more call in for Joe Queen. And Carolyn joins us from Louisville, Kentucky.
Hello.
Hi, Caroline.
Hi, can you hear me?
I hear you fine.
Hi. I just wanted to call in. First of all, what a fantastic show today.
Oh, thank you.
I listen to you all the time. I actually am married into a British family as well, and I just wanted to make the comment that traveling in England with so much extended family really gives an entirely different perspective, I think, than say, someone who doesn't know anyone there. I find that the people are very welcoming and open.
So if you're traveling with natives, as it were, people will be forthcoming?
I think so. I think that in British culture, it's still very accepted to have letters of introduction. I guess that's the old time, but connections, I guess.
Did you find, amongst those national characteristics, you did not list aloof or off-putting, Joe Queenan?
No, I find that, I don't think that there's anything better than being an American living at this time in the history of mankind from the point of view of traveling in those countries, traveling in France, traveling in England, traveling in Wales, Scotland, in that you are, people overseas, 89% of the people in Britain oppose the war in Iraq, okay? But people, they're always distinguished between American politics and Americans in general. So when you're there, I think you're always seen as sort of a representative of James Dean, as sort of a representative of Hollywood, as kind of a representative of Harrison Ford. It's just that you're always a representative of what people overseas like about Americans. And what they like is they like pop culture, and they like Americans' energy, and they like the fact that Americans just kind of wade into things. The Americans are always just sort of just, yeah, let's go. Let's get in. I mean, I was in northern England one day, and I Hadrian's Wall was about 7 miles away, and I just said, get a cab. I've always wanted to say to somebody, Hadrian's Wall, and step on it. And the woman at the train station says, well, I don't think we've ever had anybody ask for that before. Well, why shouldn't you take a cab to Hadrian's Wall? I mean, it's just like taking a cab to the Tate Museum. But the thing was, is that it was the idea of taking the cab and then having the guy kind of wait. And it's like, well, it's only taking me 7 or 8 minutes to take in Hadrian's Wall. But I think that Americans, that if you do have that entry card that you get from being related to someone, that it's great, that people will treat you very well. But one other thing about it that's interesting is, even when you know the Brits for a long time, they're very hesitant to ask you personal questions. So I was married to my wife for 20 years before my brother-in-law asked me what I did for a living.
That's a personal question.
Yeah. Where does your money come from? Whereas with Americans, as soon as you walk into a room, it's how much money do you have? What did your kids get in the SATs? How much is your house worth? Why are you driving an Acura?
Well, we wound up with this email from Paul in Portland, Oregon. I found it interesting while in England about how the Brits said cricket was far superior to American baseball. I couldn't convince them otherwise. My £2 worth. I enjoy the show. I think it's actually 2 pence worth. But thank you, Paul, for the email. Joe Queenan, thank you very much for being with us.
Thank you.
Joe Queenan, the author most recently of Queenan Country, A Reluctant Anglophile's Pilgrimage to the Mother Country. He joined us here in Studio 3A.